Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 41. Man, we're getting... There's a lot. Thank you very much for tuning in. I need to deal with some ad stuff, but before I do that, I need to thank you because the Gail Porter episode... I record these a little bit in advance. It's the first time I've had a chance to address, and thank you for this. The Gail Porter episodes went down insanely well, like mind-blowingly well. It was amazing. It's the first time we've had over 100,000 downloads in a week. And think about that for a second. If you've heard that podcast, then you'll know that we talk a lot about kind of a women's rights and some of the restrictions put upon a women in part one and part two. But also we talk a lot about mental health and depression, and we talk about alopecia, and we talk about some heavy subjects, and those subjects have had a crowd bigger than the full capacity of Wembley Stadium. I'll let that sink in for a second. That's absolutely insane. Thank you so much. And that's come from you guys spreading it word of mouth. We don't have a marketing budget here. We don't have a press team working the podcast. All the coverage we get is you guys sharing it with people and word of mouth. And if you look in, I've mentioned this before, but if you look in the top 10 on the iTunes chart, they're generally all the BBC or big American companies and things like that. This podcast is just me and my mate Warren mixing and mastering it. And obviously the amazing guests each week. And then after that, the big power that is pushing us up there to compete with all these huge companies and industries is you guys and your word of mouth. So thank you so much. I urge you to spread the word on this as regularly as you can. And it's easy to hear that and then ignore it, because I've listened to tons of podcasts over the years, and I would spread the word on a lot of them, because I'm that kind of nerd that wants everyone to know about the cool thing that I've found. But I'd ignore it as well. It's one of the reasons that when I started this podcast, I talk about so many other podcasts intentionally and recommend so many other podcasts along the way to spread the word and pay that love back. So yeah, if you can keep spreading the word, that would be amazing. And if we're speaking of people power and fan power, then Miss Amanda fucking Palmer is the one to discuss this. But before we get into that, I need to mention the sponsor, speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That is my record label. Please go and check us out. For just £5, you can buy my Edinburgh Fringe show. It's a fiver and it's a download. You can get a 2-DVD set for £15. There's loads of good stuff there. As you will have heard, as you're about to hear, we've got some new Distraction Pieces exclusive t-shirts, but I'm not even going to go into that yet. That's going to be a little segment that tells you where you go and get them. But yeah, check out the Distraction Pieces. Cracking up. What's going on? Very unprofessional. Check out the Distraction Pieces podcast. What am I? I've lost my words. Speechdevelopmentrecords.com. I can only apologise for how sloppy this is, but it's going to be made up for in a minute because I'm going to talk for an hour with the amazing Miss Amanda Palmer. So honoured and blessed to get to have this conversation. She allowed me to come in. I mean, we discussed how we met and how we've known each other, but regardless of already knowing each other in advance, it was incredibly gracious of her to allow me to come and set up in her dressing room at the Union Chapel hours before she took the stage for her second sold-out night there. Whilst heavily pregnant... Make no mistake about it, she's heavily pregnant right now. So it was amazing to get to talk to her, and the chat went better than I could have hoped. We only had an hour, but it was perfect because we filled the hour. We fit so much in. We discussed a lot of subjects that have been controversial for her over the years that she hasn't had a chance to really discuss. And yeah, before we get going, I need to tell you about my film night. I did a podcast a while ago with Paul Vickery, who works at the Prince Charles Cinema, which if you listen to this, you could very well be interesting, because it's about independent as cinema, and again, about kind of the power of the people. It's a beautiful chat. And after that one, the next film night I had was Ghost Dog, and it was rammed in there. So thank you all for coming along and supporting. So I need to tell you about this week's one, A Menace to Society. on Thursday the 18th of June. I've also got Dancer in the Dark on Thursday the 30th of July. But it's at the Prince Charles Cinema. Tickets for sale on their website. Please come along. The Ghost Dog one was amazing because that's a favourite film of mine. And I always talk about how the point of these nights is to put on films that I've maybe loved for years but only ever watched on DVD. And I think the cinema experience is completely different because you're in the darkness and you're just completely drawn into it. Rather than when you're at home, you're looking at your phone or looking around your living room where you can hear cars going past. It's a completely all-encompassing experience in the cinema. But something I hadn't accounted for until this one was how much of a difference it makes having other people there. There were so many huge laughs in Ghost Dog, which I didn't really experience or get at home, and watching it with a crowd had that. And I mean, I'm excited about A Menace to Society for that exact fact, because that was a film that when that came out, it was a real pass around the blank a VCR of it. You know, when I was at school, it was like, Hitler, you've got to watch this, but you can't get caught watching it. So to watch that in a room full of people is going to be absolutely amazing. So check that out. It's Menace to Society, Thursday, 18th of June. And then next month, we've got Dancer in the Dark, Thursday, the 30th of July. It would also be amiss of me to not mention my club night that I have monthly. We're returning to the book club now. Classic. I love it at the book club. It's our home. We do the night other places every now and then. I'm going to let you in on a secret. Nowhere is as good as the book club. I don't mean to hate anyone. We have great parties everywhere, but the book club is our spiritual home. So on the 27th of June, we are at the book club. I'll be DJing. We've got a Layton from Beats International. We've got Ricky Hall, who's been on the podcast, international male model and generally good bloke. And he can spin a record or two too. We've got DJ Destruction, who every time we have the club night, everyone kind of agrees is the best DJ they've ever heard and never heard of. We've got Push Music, who's amazing. We've got Redshift Rebels. We've got Disco Stew, if we have to. It's really good. Come down to the book club. Saturday, the 27th of June. Doors, 8 p.m. till 2 a.m. Free before 9 p.m. and £5 after. If you want to get on the guaranteed entry list or the queue jump list, it's send your names to info@thetrashsociety.com. info@thetrashsociety.com. Yeah, hopefully see you there. It's good. It's always good to catch up with a lot of you. I'm getting more and more people come along to both these events, and always I'm there for ages at them and chat with everyone. Getting more and more people come to those events who are fans of the podcast, and hopefully I'll start to get some come along in Team 3W t-shirts, but more about that shortly. So let's get into the podcast. Oh, I've not mentioned as well, also I have to mention, on Friday, so in 2 days' time, we've got a Refugee Week special of the Distraction Pieces podcast. It's in collaboration with the British Red Cross. I'm doing a project with them that the aim is to help kind of give a greater understanding to refugees and tell their story, because I think in recent years there's been so much about immigration and all sorts of other nonsense that is blurring the facts and the reality of who some of these people are. So I've got the chance to sit down with a refugee and hear their story. We're trying to get it ready for Friday. I've not recorded it yet, so it's one of them that it's scheduled. If everything goes to plan, it'll be on Friday. But yeah, we'll have to. You'll have to keep an eye out for that. The best way is to subscribe. Yeah, so check that out. This is episode 41 with Amanda fucking Palmer. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. I'm joined right now by Amanda Palmer. How are you doing?
I'm lovely, thanks.
By a resplendently pregnant Amanda Palmer. How's that going?
That's such a great word. it's going. I'm almost six months pregnant.
Wow.
And I'm in that what they say is the sort of like moony glowing middle trimester.
Yeah.
Where you're not sick and nauseous and tired and grossed out the way you are for the first 3 months.
Perfect.
But you're
on tour,
but you're
then,
also
right?
not you've planned so this carefully. Heavy you're waddling.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so it's actually, it's quite nice being on tour pregnant because you're special.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, we were discussing this beforehand. The weird thing of touring is you'll get into a venue and, you know, you're kind of special anyway because you're there to headline a gig. It's not arrogant or rude to have certain needs. Like the thing I always feel is it wasn't until I was touring that I realised how important our Wi-Fi codes were and water and simple things like that.
You have to have it.
That if you're not from, if you don't tour, particularly touring in another country where your phone might not have as much freedom as usual, it's amazing how important those things are. Yet you do feel like a bit of a dick sometimes being, seriously, we can't do anything else until I get the Wi-Fi code.
Right.
We really need
well,
to.
Yeah, well, and you're constantly a guest in, like, you're the special one, but you're also a guest in somebody else's house.
Yeah.
And
but the advantage of being pregnant in
when
that
you're
situation
pregnant,
is there's no demand.
When you're pregnant, every demand feels justified.
Yeah.
Every, like, you know, every need feels... I think a lot of artists probably struggle with this, especially when you're on the road and you're at the mercy of every environment and every situation. You definitely are constantly struggling with your own selfishness and dickishness, but you have no home, you're on the road, and you need a thing, and you have to ask for it because you are actually occupied and you can't go do it. But you don't want to feel like you're enslaving the people around you.
Completely.
And it's an art in itself. Like people who tour, who have been touring for years and years and years and really have figured out that dance are admirable to watch.
It's where people get really militant or clinical on their riders and things like that, because then it's just making sure that all those small things that aren't that important but are there, so you don't have to be awkward to be like, I really need some milk for my tea or something, something like that. It's kind of, it's an advantage. It's a skill.
It's a skill, and I mean, even just not touring musicians have it. It's a skill of a traveler.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is like you've got your essential shit on you, but then you also are constantly engaged in a dialogue with your environment.
Yeah.
And you learn how to live in different environments. And I've spent a lot of time doing that.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like there's a whole sub book of the book that I just wrote about how to live in other people's environments.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
it's definitely a skill.
Yeah,
it's a huge
and
skill.
Most bands learn this skill. You know, no one teaches you to do it.
No.
But like, if you're a small, scrappy band touring in a car and staying with your fans and staying with your friends, you learn this whole sort of like subcultural skill set of like how to be a guest in someone else's house every single night.
Yeah, a survival etiquette.
And there's all these gives and takes of like, you actually do need some privacy or some space or their Wi-Fi, but they're also hosting you and they kind of want some social time from you or whatever it is. And it's like, you don't really talk about it. You don't talk about it as a skill and a learned skill and an education, but it really is.
Yeah, completely. Particularly, I mean, obviously I want to have a good talk about the book and about your choice at times of touring and staying with fans and things like that. It is an insane skill because it's such a balance. You're there, they're helping you out, but equally you're at work, essentially. You know, you're on the road, you're on tour. So that balance of being, giving them everything that they need so they feel it's worked for them, and equally being, well, you know, I need a minute.
Yeah.
I need a minute. I've been on the road in a van with tons of people for
and
days.
And some people really immediately grok that and understand it. And some people don't, you know. I mean, when I look for people to stay with, I look for their social skills much more than I look for the comfort of their actual home.
Yeah, brilliant.
Because
that's
their
perfect.
Social skills are so much
the
more
key.
Comforting if they're good than having a nice cushy bed in your own room.
So, I mean, before we get on to the book, which again lends into this, and I want to talk about what the nature of this particular tour is. Let's talk about exactly that, your history of staying with fans, of engaging with fans. I think essentially the basis of the book is about that. It's about that whether it's fans or anyone, the engagement of other people and everyone kind of obviously being comfortable to ask for help and building in that way. So how do you go about, I mean, you said you look for more social skills. How do you choose who you're going to, because again, it's got to be a digital thing a lot of the time.
Yeah.
It's got to be a roll of the dice a lot of the time where you're, right.
I mean, So, I mean, the book's called The Art of Asking.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the whole way I approached what I was going to write about in the book was looking at asking as a learned skill.
Yeah.
And all of the strange paradoxes of, you know, how it feels to rely on others and to ask others and to sort of reframe the idea of needing help from others or asking others for help, which is coming up all the time nowadays.
Yeah.
Because of crowdfunding.
Yeah, indeed.
And to reframe it not as this, like, uncomfortable, vulnerable, terrible, you know, this thing that seems like a burden on
yeah.
society or on your friends or on your community, but instead just sort of looking, like, stepping back and looking at the larger ecosystem of how we all help each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like there's so many ways to approach this. I mean, you could write a whole book about capitalism
yeah.
and just talk about how screwy things have gotten now that we think of everything in terms of monetary exchange
yeah.
and how we think about value
yeah.
and how we apply what we think about art to how we think about value. I mean, there's so many great tangents.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy.
And I basically, like, I was really lucky that I had to write the book on a deadline because
right,
the more
yeah.
I wrote, I was like, oh my God, and there's this, and
there's this.
And,
yeah.
and what I should actually do is just, like, research for 6 years because I need to look at the history
yeah.
of busking, and I need to look at the history of capitalism, and I need to look at the history of gift exchange and Indian tribal cultures. And it was like,
yeah,
yeah, no, I'm just not going to do
that. Yeah, I mean, it's such a broad subject, kind of figuratively, in a way. I mean, the whole, it's obviously based largely around, in your experiences and your career
yeah.
in music and the being the crowned queen of Kickstarter, which we'll get into as well, really.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in general, the fear of asking is a huge problem, I think, in society. We've had, a couple of weeks ago, we had a podcast that went down incredibly popular, and it was with a lady, Gail Porter, and talking about depression and just the fact of asking for help in general and how that's such a feared thing, and
yeah.
the admission that in general humans aren't made in this crazy world that we've built, aren't made to cope with all this on our own.
No,
it's a million times over the capabilities of our brains,
and yet we
think asking for help in any way is, oh no, that's
well,
weakness.
And we've gotten so disconnected from our ability to sort of tribally take care of each
yeah,
other.
Completely. You'd previously ask for help from, you'd get advice from the shaman, from the elders, from whoever else, whereas now we're so distant whilst more connected with social
yeah,
media.
It's
that weird thing
the
of
connection
not...
is a frail, fragile...
It really
untrusted,
is.
Untrustable
completely.
Connection.
I mean, the paranoia through all digital interaction is insane, and the removal of tone. You know, if someone wishes to interpret your request as unreasonable, then
exactly.
they can, because it's just written down.
Or if anybody from the outside world, and I mean, I certainly have experienced a lot of this,
yeah.
just happens to be standing at a distance, witnessing your exchange,
yeah.
and decides to yell at you because they don't like your exchange. You are really vulnerable, and the internet makes everyone really vulnerable because the exchanges are visible, and they're not just done,
yeah,
you know, in our little village street of, like, I'll give you some bread if you walk my dog. Because, you know, usually there's no one around to judge that
yeah.
stuff. But if all of a sudden the whole world is casting their eyes down in
yeah.
judgment on, like, well, we actually think that the bread is worth a lot more than that fucking dog walking.
And
we're going to now,
yeah,
we're gonna now
yeah.
attack.
And changing how you feel about asking, but equally how the person you're asking feels about being asked.
Right.
So let's jump to a publicised example of that. When you were touring and you talked about asking a local bands and talents to come and play at the shows, and it caused quite an uproar because people were then saying no,
right.
musicians have a fee and a standard, and it's something I've had problems with online before. I've done contests or campaigns with small bands on my label saying, look, if there's any artists who'd like to submit a design, then that'd be great. And in our mind, it's like, cool, this cool interaction and collaboration. People have then got furious to
yeah,
saying
of course.
No, that there's a fee and a price, and neither side is wrong. Oh, really? There's a place
totally.
For correctness on each side. But the example I instantly came to, I was reading it and trying to, again, obviously because we know each other a bit, I'm often a bias in your favour. But when these things are coming up, I try and be right. Let's be reasonable and think. And the thing that just came to mind with, for me was essentially how we met was we met on a radio show and you asked if I fancied coming and playing at one of your shows.
Yeah.
And I did. And it was an amazing collaboration.
And I didn't offer you £200.
You didn't offer me money. I didn't ask. It was just, wow, this sounds cool.
Yeah. So
why is... Because that was personal interaction without onlooking eyes, it was fine.
Exactly. And I would have been zero offended if you had said, no, it's just not worth my time. It's just not worth my time and energy to come and do this.
Yeah.
And I think the important in all of these exchanges, whether it's like, you know, submit a design or come play on stage, the main factor that seems to get missed by the people who are criticizing it is that it's a mutual exchange.
Yeah.
And I'm totally allowed to ask you, and you're totally allowed to say no. But if 100%. Both people step up and say, like, yes, this is mutually beneficial, I want to invite you, you want to come to my gig, then the outside judgment really sort of doesn't understand the system.
I couldn't agree more. I'm fine with someone responding and saying, look, my art has a value, and you're asking me to do it under that. I'm not willing to do it. That's absolutely fine.
Yeah, but that's fine.
But it's when they're... imposing it on other people who were maybe excited or enthusiastic to be involved in this project, right. Then it seems unfair. It's like,
here's the thing. And I looked, I felt into this deeply when I was dealing with this particular controversy, which was asking specifically, I asked string players and horn players of basically any talent level, you know, they had to be above like a grade school level, but they didn't have to be great. They just had to be able to read charts to come and play on stage with my band so we could beef up some of the songs. And we didn't really have the budget to like tour, you know, get an extra tour bus and 12.
Getting an orchestra is a huge, it's not like you were saying, oh, I want a free guitarist every night.
No,
because a guitarist is someone who can pop in the car.
So an important part of the system to understand is, had no one said yes, we probably just wouldn't have done it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's important to understand. The other thing that's important to understand about this stuff is I kept like trying to get a perspective on why now and why is this so upsetting to people now?
Yeah.
And I think on the one hand, I had just made a lot of money, you know, or seemingly made a lot of money on Kickstarter.
Of course.
No one knew what my actual nets and grosses were. They just saw the giant, like, blinking sign in the sky. But also, if you look at what's happening in general with the crumbling infrastructure of how people are, how artists are getting paid, there's no wonder journalists are freaking out about, you know, specifically now about people asking them to work for free.
Yeah.
And musicians are freaking out specifically now. Because if you're a classically trained violinist, your work opportunities now in 2015 versus 10 years ago versus 20 years ago are just dwindling forever further downward.
Hugely.
And so you're getting testier and more frightened.
Yeah.
And, you know, and for those who are looking for something to blame, I think it's, you know, it could be easy to look at me and say, like, it's people like Amanda Palmer. But that's actually bullshit. I'm not the culprit at all. And you see this all the time with, like, you know... especially journalists and like Garbage just went through this because they asked if any photographers wanted to just submit photographs they had taken for a book. And they got the exact same thing of like one of the photographers wrote this scathing open letter saying like, how you are garbage. How dare you ask me to submit my work for free when you're this giant band and I'm this photographer. Yeah. And of course, you know whose side I'm going to land
of
on,
course,
which is like, they can ask.
Yeah.
You can say no. Just say no.
Just say no.
It's
absolutely fine. I've done
or tell them, you know what? My work is really great. Can you at least give me $500?
Yeah.
You know, and I will give you these 10 images because I'd love to be involved in your project, but I really do need the money.
Completely.
And then they can say no. Fine.
I've done so much over my career working with people, everyone working for free. And then when it happens to turn a profit, paying everyone a little bit.
Yeah.
But I'd much rather, even if I'm aware in the end they're going to get paid, I'd much rather work with people who are doing it just for the passion and just because they're excited. And then it's a nice surprise to go, here's a check, dude.
Right.
Thank you so much for engaging. Rather than people who are like, well, here's my day rate. And again, I'm not having... I kind of am having a go there, which I shouldn't. it's being the opposite of what I was saying there.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I get more excited because of how I work, because of the fact...
And it doesn't it depend on the project, though?
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to walk into a music studio and only just work with an engineer who's psyched to be there.
Yeah,
I would be more excited to work with a guy who's like, here's my day rate, you know, I'm an engineer, this is my studio, this is what it costs. It's all context, you know, that's completely different from like making, you know, a video on a rooftop with a budget of $1,000 where like it's going to expand and contract depending on how many people decide that they want to show up and paint themselves naked.
Completely.
And the other side of it though is the, you know, and journalists talking about this all the time too, it's like, you know, there's a movement against interning, against unpaid interning. Yep. Sort of for the same reason. And, you know, I've been an unpaid intern. I interned at a record store, you know, just to kind of be around.
Yeah,
and
completely.
The thing I keep pointing out to all these people who criticize, you know, the photographer with the angry open letter and all of this stuff is my band played 2 years worth of gigs pretty much for free.
Yeah.
We played my house, my friends' houses, any art gallery opening.
Yeah.
Like, basically anyone who asked us if we would gig, we would gig. And I sort of look back to those times, and I'm like, if we had just initially refused to play without payment, my band would have gone fucking nowhere.
Yeah, yeah.
If we had just said, but we're musicians and our work has value and you have to at least pay us $100, we would have just been passed over because the people didn't have the budget or it wasn't worth it to them to get a band, but it was worth it to us to play the gig.
Yeah, completely.
And so in all of these situations, I think it comes down to like respect the fucking artist.
Yeah.
Respect the artist's decision.
Respect their choice.
Exactly.
To do it or not. I mean, I should quickly tell the story of... So we met on a Six Music show and we got on. We're familiar
Stevie
with each
Lamac.
Other on Old Lamac. A shout out to Steve Lamac. And you asked if I wanted to come and perform at your show. I think it was a couple of nights away. It was at the end of the week. And I was going to another gig in Camden that night that I promised I'd attend, but I said I'll still come along. And it was beautiful because I literally got there four or five songs before I was to perform.
Yeah, we were already on stage.
We'd not rehearsed. I'd not met any of the bands. I'd met you. I'd not met any of the band. And literally, just when the time came, you kind of gave me a shout. And we came out and performed at this thing. And that wouldn't have happened if there had been any level of professionalism involved.
No.
If we'd said, right, look, we've not had time to sound check, so I'm not really up for this. But the fact was, it was like, cool. Let's give that a chance. And in my thinking as well, I think a lot of the time it's thinking... of remembering, and I'm not telling anyone else how to run their own artistic lives or career, but remembering that I've been going to gigs since I was about 14, and if any band I was watching had said, "Are you up for getting up for a song?" I would have been so happy.
Right.
So the fact that someone's saying, "Are you up for coming on for a song?" It's like, cool. It's not the ideal situation. It would have been nice if we'd met or practiced, but it went amazingly. So
right, and I also like I love taking little risks like that on stage because you know it doesn't always work, and you don't always have like sometimes you'll pop someone on stage and just be like, no, just do a spontaneous thing, and they're not good at doing a spontaneous thing. Like, and sometimes you just don't know. And I have had plenty. Of moments of, you know, after like 10 years of almost nonstop touring, I've had plenty of moments of like, well, shit, that didn't work. But then that's also, it's part of the beauty of having this constant community and this constant touring life, which is I never do the same thing twice. The audience never really knows what they're going to see. They know they're going to see something authentic.
Yep.
And they know they might see something fail. And that's great.
I think
it's
that's
kind of part
that's
of it.
Why it's. I think it's one of the reasons you've got such passionate, engaging fans. Is exactly that there's some excitement in the live performance again. You know, it got to a point a few years back where people were going to gigs to hear a song played note for note, the same as it was on the record. It's like that's kind of
boring.
It takes so much out of it. It's like just to be honest. I mean, I live in a small town outside of London. To be honest, I could stay at home and listen. To the record, it'd be a lot easier. I've travelled for 90 minutes. I want something to go wrong. I want it to be an error or a mistake.
Least, you at least want to feel like you're actively being with the person on stage.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, the idea that they're just up there representing something that they have to, and then they're fucking off.
Yeah.
And I, you know, my favourite live shows have been, even if the music sounds note for note like the shit on the record. Maybe that's great, but there's an attitude,
yeah, completely,
of authenticity on stage that, like, we are people here, you are people there, and right now we're together.
Yeah.
And there's so many ways of doing that. You don't have to do it the, like, chaotic circus Amanda Palmer way, yeah. And you don't have to, you know, but there is something, you know, even with people who do, like, high-end pop spectacle,
yeah.
You can feel the difference between someone who's kind of phoning it in and just painting, yeah, by the numbers, and someone who is...
Who means it every time they're out there.
Who means it and embraces the mistakes when they happen instead of trying to hide them from the audience, yeah, and all that kind of stuff. And, I mean, I've gone and seen some massive pop spectacle shows, and some of them are just, like, even with their gazillion-dollar budgets, you're just bored.
Yeah.
Because you don't feel like you are part of a living exchange.
Who do you think on that level gets it right?
On the giant pops. I mean, I haven't seen that many giant pop shows.
I'm only asking because it's an excuse for me to talk again about when I saw Prince live and his full band, his just general demeanour and attitude. It was like, man, they've probably not even written down a set list. They're just that good. They're that tight. Yeah. They're just going... Let's pull this song.
Well, Prince is in the James Brown lineage. Yeah. He is in the, like, I will have a band that's tight as shit.
Yeah.
I'm in whatever the wrong lineage is. I'm in the, like, the probably, like, the Grateful Dead lineage where, yeah, it's like, hey.
Yeah, we all get on. This is cool.
Do are we missing a musician? Maybe. Yeah, I mean, I have never been very exacting,
yeah,
about my stage players. But then again, I'm much more important. It's much more important to me about whether I like the people,
yeah,
I'm
that's
working
fine.
With.
I mean, you're going to be on the
and
road
I'm enjoying
with them for
myself.
A time.
And even if we're sloppy as fuck, I don't really care. But
you see, that surprises me a little to hear because having seen you live a couple of times now, two or three times with the band, it's always felt that it's so tight and it's got that you've got talented enough musicians there to allow you to go off script. And
right.
Then to bring it back like that,
yeah,
if you need
they
to.
All have to be good improv.
Yeah,
you know, they need to be good at spontaneity.
Again, which was a great surprise as I walked out on stage in front of a full venue.
Yeah, just to,
like,
just
turns
to
out they're really good at this.
This.
Turns out these guys are awesome.
Yeah, and Michael, the drummer on that tour, yeah, was the kind of person who, like, he comes from the theater world,
yeah,
and he and I definitely spoke the language, yeah, of, like, we want to make this an amazing live theatrical,
yeah,
experience,
yeah,
and, like. You know, we sort of looked at everything through the filter of opportunity. Like, we would,
yeah,
walk into every venue and go, like, ooh, let's
use
that.
Do it there. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, if I had had the kind of drummer who was like a stock studio drummer, you might have walked up on stage and said, I'm going to read this thing. And everyone would have just sort of sat there twiddling
their
thumbs.
And, yeah,
and this drummer is like, fuck, can I play along with you?
Let's go.
Yeah, let's go. Let's do a thing. We're here. And it also takes a certain kind of personality to be like, let's do a thing in front of 1,200 people.
Yeah.
And,
if you've
and
that,
know that this thing won't be quite perfect because, like, he doesn't know how your piece is going to go.
Yeah,
he doesn't even know how long your piece,
yeah,
is.
Yeah.
But that's, like, that's the great
again,
dance.
I cover up enough of my face with hair to get away with covering any slight wavers in when it's not going right. I can keep that, this is going exactly to plan look when,
yeah,
it is. Again, I was the same. I was thinking, I don't know if it's going to kick in now, if it's going to stop. But
yeah.
But so how is it at the moment to go from having... numerous band members and a huge backing to this tour where you're on your own to succeed or fail on your own. Obviously, there's often a guest as is expected from an Amanda Palmer show. It'd be,
yeah,
outrageous otherwise.
Yeah, but I'm spending 95% of my stage time,
yeah,
alone.
Alone up there.
I love
it.
I love it and I love both. I mean, I think...
Have you done much... Without a backing band,
no,
or anything before?
No, this is... I mean, I toured for years and years and years and years with the Dresden,
yeah,
Dolls.
Yeah, of course.
Which was a band.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was always just me and Brian on stage, like,
yeah,
going at each other. And then when I went solo and did my first solo album, I toured, but I was rarely... I was only alone on stage about half the time because I brought,
yeah,
a troupe of Australian performance artists with me.
Of course.
Of course I did.
Of course
and
did.
I also brought a cellist and a violin player.
Yeah.
So it was still kind of like a moving circus on,
yeah,
stage with a pretty set list. And then, you know, I sort of, I learned how to do a little bit more solo stuff in the cracks there. But then the next big album was the Grand Theft Orchestra album.
Of course.
Which was the one I met you on. And that was full band.
Yeah.
You know, I think huge I did two solo really. Songs in that set. So, like, huge production, huge band, and the whole deal. And this is the first time... And then I took a year off to write a book.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I'm doing, like, proper long tours... With just me showing up with a ukulele case and sitting down at a piano and sound checking.
Amazing.
And I love it.
Of course you do.
Because I'm so free all of a sudden. And I get to change. I get to take requests. I get to fucking talk for 5 minutes if I want to.
Yeah.
I change the set list up every night. I learn new covers backstage.
Yeah, that's great.
And it's very powerful. But it's also kind of lonely.
Yeah, of course.
And it's sort of like, you know, it's sort of like asking someone if they... you know, prefer hanging out alone to hanging out in a crowd. It's like you need a healthy mix of both or you go crazy.
Completely. And I genuinely think, I guarantee you'll find when you return to having a band, you'll just feel it's so much tighter and so much more in control. Because I think a period of time having to fill that stage on your own really lets you hone your stagecraft and really lets you, even though you've been doing it for years and know it's tight, it really lets you know, right, this really works. And I can, I don't know, I can turn it into a real show and a real performance because I've done that on my own and filled that time and filled the gaps and lived and died on my own cross, as it were.
Yeah.
It's gone good and it's gone bad, you know?
Yeah. And there's something particularly just about drums.
Yeah.
That just, it's like, drums are just drums. There's nothing else like drums in a room to just shut people the fuck up and get them into I'm at a show mode.
Yeah,
and completely. As loud and as aggressively as I pound a concert grand piano, I mean, and it's really emotional and powerful and you can hear a pin drop in the audience, but it's never drums.
Yeah, yeah.
And drums are special. So... But
drums also have to be loaded in and out of a venue, and that's just hideous. So there's pros and cons. Let's get this real.
but yeah, I've been loving this, and also being pregnant and doing this tour, it feels a little bit selfish in a good way.
Yeah,
like this is my time with my crowd.
Yeah,
and it's very personal because what I'm going through right now is fucking scary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's really personal. And I would imagine, you know, if for some reason the universe was altered and I was on tour right now with Michael and Chad and Jarek and my light guy and, you know, and my sound guy and, you know, and whoever, and I was traveling as a posse of 10 people and on stage every night, still kind of communing with the audience about what I'm going through, it would feel a few steps more selfish.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I don't, you know, like... sitting down and talking with a crowd of a bunch of people about my fears about pregnancy is an amazing moment, but it's not quite as amazing if you've got a drummer sitting there waiting for you to shut the fuck up.
Waiting for you to start the next song and be like, are we going now?
Yeah.
Can I have a toilet break or?
So this also feels like the right time because these shows are...
I was going to say the timing just all seems to be insanely perfect with, I mean, the book... coming out as well, it feels like it fits with this kind of tour that bit more.
Yeah.
Not that you're getting up and it's just a book reading, but you can engage in more parts of that and bring elements of this in and out of the live performance.
Yeah, and I mean, there's also a sense in which, you know, the book is kind of scary to me because it definitely feels like a. I mean, it certainly does feel like a creation and its own piece of art.
Yeah.
But it also feels very explainy.
Yeah.
You know, and very much rehashing of the past and saying, I did this and this is what I thought and these are my reflections.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's very important to, I mean, you can cycle, but you can't stay there.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And, I mean, sometimes I look at my life now as, you know, writer, TED speaker, you know, inspirational Amanda Palmer. And I could fucking, if I wanted to be an asshole, I could ride that wave for 10 years and like go around doing people's, you know, doing speaking engagements and podcasts and writing three more books about crowdfunding as like the magical musician who like cracked the code and figured out how to And like, that's so boring.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel
it's
like
easy.
It's easy and it feels inauthentic.
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
you're only allowed to reflect for a certain, you have this grace period and
completely.
Then you have to go out and keep doing shit. You can't just keep reflecting on your past.
It feels like the book should be a, right, here's the full stop on what's happened here. You know, wow. There's been some shit going on. There's been a lot going on. I've now explained it all. Is there ever that element of wanting to say to people, just read the book.
Yeah.
And then we don't need to have this discussion any longer. We don't need to, you know, it's finished there. It's all explained. So
yeah,
we don't need
much,
this.
Yeah, pretty much, actually. And I mean, and the TED Talk felt like it was supposed to be that.
Yeah.
Because I went through a year of internet controversy.
Yeah.
And it was just like, I just felt like I was getting my face punched in once a week by one thing or another.
Man, it's real humans out there.
And
it's a real human behind that screen.
I was offered the TED Talk and I was like, this is the perfect opportunity to kind of put a punctuation mark
on the right
on.
To reply, essentially. And say,
I'm going to get on the world stage. I'm going to try to explain to you once and for all who I am, what I believe, and how I think this can work.
Mm.
And then I can be done.
How was that? How was the TED Talk? Obviously, it went down amazingly, but beforehand, yeah. Was there ever a point of realization, right, I've done years of going out in front of my crowd,
yeah.
And that, you know, they're there for me, they're there to embrace me. That isn't what this is. This is a separate thing. I'm a speaker to these people. I'm not... Obviously, I am Amanda Palmer, but I'm not that.
But
it's not
of
that
those
situation.
People knew me.
Yeah,
they were strangers.
This is me going out now and having to get everything into this moment. And you know, again, the beauty of your own live shows with your own fans is there's a shorthand there. There's
right.
a knowledge of
you
history, a knowledge of who you are.
Right.
I don't need to explain that it's okay that I'm naked at the moment or anything
right.
like that. You know, it's explained throughout the history of your work.
Well, so,
whereas that's a new thing right now.
Right. I mean, and it's not just that I was speaking. I mean, the TED conference itself
yeah.
is like 1,500 tech billionaires,
yeah.
basically.
Yeah.
Which I didn't even really fully grasp until I got there.
It's probably
and
for
I
the
was
best.
Like, oh my God,
yeah,
there
yeah.
you are. You're Al Gore and Jeff Bezos
yeah.
and like the other
Damn,
Illuminati.
Yeah.
But the thing about the TED Talk that wouldn't have worked and wouldn't have happened if I hadn't gone through like the battering ram of internet controversy is I felt so deeply misunderstood.
Yeah, yeah.
And every time, you know, every time a controversy erupted of like Amanda Palmer shouldn't be using Kickstarter, Amanda Palmer shouldn't be asking her fans to volunteer, Amanda Palmer shouldn't be writing poems about the Boston bomber, Amanda mm-hmm. Palmer. And I was just like, oh, actually, like, when I set out to do all of these things, I had no idea that you would misunderstand this.
Yeah.
I just was sort of like rolling along my merry way going like, oh, well, use Kickstarter. Oh,
yeah.
I'll do these things that I always do. And it was sort of the growing pains of being exposed to the wider world and going, holy fuck, I had no idea that you guys
yeah.
didn't think like me.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how much of a fucking bubble I lived in.
Which
my, like, you know, with my crazy, compassionate, arty, art fag hippie friends. Like,
which
we really
which
are different.
Everyone does. Everyone does. I mean, it's reflected in every single election. When people are shocked that it didn't
right.
go the way they wanted, it's because we generally surround ourselves with like-minded people. Therefore,
right.
in our minds, and even though we've got this access to view the opinions of so many people in the world of different opinions, we generally only follow people and engage with people
yeah,
who
we're
are
all
like-minded,
living in these filter bubbles.
Which is completely natural. But it then makes it. I don't know. I don't think people should be surprised then when you then go,
it's shocking.
All right. I thought the world was one way. It's like, no, your world is
right.
that way. And that's beautiful and fine. But that doesn't mean the rest
of the
world.
Well, and I really did. I really was shocked.
Yeah.
At not just the. I mean, I wasn't shocked at the people so far away from me
yeah.
who didn't get it.
Yeah.
That didn't surprise me. What shocked me was the people right next to me,
mm-hmm.
you know, the other people in the art scene, the other people, the other musicians. You know, the lefty journalists going,
yeah.
we don't understand how you could have compassion for someone, you know, who's a terrorist.
Yeah.
And going like, oh my God, I actually really didn't know
that
you guys
be,
didn't
yeah.
think this way. But I think I can explain it.
Yeah.
You know, and this is also where everything came back to street performing.
Yeah.
And I was like, when you're a street performer for 5 years, and that's how you make your money, and you get out there every day and you basically trust the universe and you give your shit away for free and you put a hat at your feet, you can't help but start realizing that the universe kind of is a certain way.
Yeah.
And that there is a predictable amount of trust in humanity that you can have.
Yeah.
And you're the education that happens when you're a street performer is so deep and ingrained once you're out there in the street doing it every fucking day that you just don't doubt it anymore. You sort of take it for granted. And all the other musicians that you hang out with who grew up in that lineage are like, yeah, of course, whatever. No, no, let's talk about something interesting.
Then
you talk to the guy at Forbes magazine who's like, we don't understand this. And you're just like, wow, well, I guess I have to really try to explain this to you because it seems, because I am just swimming in it like it's water.
Yeah.
But really, like, let me try to actually really explain it to you so you'll understand. Let me break it down. And that's what my TED talk was, which is I desperately really want people to understand this.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where, like, everything that went into the TED talk was, how can I say this in a way that people will really actually fundamentally understand what I'm talking about?
Do you feel a responsibility to help explain this to people? Because I think it's easy, and again, it would be easy to continue on. I don't know, I think there's a lot of things in life where it's far easier to do and exist and live it than it is to actually explain it at points. It's far easier to have gone along going, right, this is how this works, and we engage and we all work. I don't care if you don't get that.
No, I mean, I think it's more selfish than that. I think I did it for me.
Yeah.
And I did it for me knowing...
To explain and have that justification of, look, for fuck's sake.
Right. And I mean, I think I also felt... I feel my own personal pain when I look at Kickstarter videos and I see my friends or friends of friends, but basically like my posse, like flicking on the camera and going like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing, but here I am and this is, we're Kickstartering a record and...
Yeah,
and you're like you're just watching those videos going like, oh my God, someone just needs to tell you that like... There is a much better way of doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's it. I think, and you're making me feel uncomfortable. So can we just...
It should be an exciting engagement for all of us involved.
Can we just like rewind for a second and like fucking throw all that shit out and just sort of just be honest with me and tell me what you're doing. Tell me that you're crowdfunding a record. Tell me that you'd love me to help, that I don't have to help. And this is what you're doing and this is what you need.
Yeah.
And like, and don't like, and don't... cover me with shame.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That you're
but that's
you're
also
being
selfish.
And in a way,
that's me.
In a way, it's almost guilting you into helping because of it being presented in a shame.
Right.
You know, in a I'm in this spot. I need help.
Yeah.
It's an interesting one. I mean, I've discussed the whole Kickstarter thing back and forth a lot over the years, and I've decided again. I like most of the things that we've discussed here. There's no right or wrong because it's so much of a case-by-case example. I've been annoyed at points where I've seen people who simply don't wish to invest their own money or I don't know, again, just my background was I really wanted to make a record and I worked in a record store for 5 years saving up to be able to do that. And that was my Kickstarter because that didn't exist at the time. So when it's then presented as someone being... lazy or wanting an undeserved leg up, then it instantly started to rub me up the wrong way. My first impressions of Kickstarter, and then seeing more people I know doing amazing projects on there and genuinely engaging beautiful things that wouldn't exist without Kickstarter.
Well,
things
and
that
in
wouldn't
sense,
that
it
aren't
comes
investable.
Down to the artists,
it's like, all right, again. Shit, that's kind of cool. That's
yeah,
I like that.
Well, and there's a lot of shitty Kickstarters out there where you know a lot of it comes down to. Certain artists are just certain ways and certain artists are just like obnoxious and entitled and it doesn't matter whether they are using Kickstarter or trying to get signed to a label. Like it doesn't matter what they're doing.
Yeah.
They would just be shitty and be obnoxious and entitled.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you've got your other artists who are just like working from a place of like community and joy and exuberance And it doesn't matter with them either. Either they're trying to get signed to a label or they're using Kickstarter, but you can tell they're in it for the right reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're kind of approaching it with gratitude and not a sense of like, I fucking deserve this because like, and you can just like, and the system is irrelevant.
Yeah,
it
completely.
It comes down to the people behind the
completely.
System.
Again, I think the way to make it work is present something that's an engagement and an interaction between you and those donating or engaging or whatever, rather than the feeling, as you said, on when people are kind of a bit, oh, woe is me about it, there's then a thing of, right, I'm donating, therefore I feel my entitlement to... Do you know what I mean? So it feels less like a transaction.
Yeah.
Because that's the point of record labels at points, of advances. Again, if a label has given you a huge advance, I've always felt they have a right to say, here's what we want from that. Or
see,
for
I never
that.
Believed that.
I've never had an advance. You see, I've never had a large advance.
I mean, I always looked at it from, the naive point of view, but I think, you know, maybe naive in a way that has a deeper intelligence, which is if you're a record label giving me an advance to make a record, the deal should be I'm the artist, I get to make the record.
Yeah, I get
and you're
that.
Paying not for the record that you want, but you're paying me to make the record that I'm making.
Yeah.
And I've never felt... I got so many journalists when I launched the Kickstarter asking me that exact question, which is, aren't you afraid now that your fans are going to dominate you and control you and boss you and demand things? And it had never, again, like it had never occurred to me that my fans would ever demand everything. Because to me, that's not what the exchange is.
Yeah.
The exchange isn't you give me $10 and you get to tell me what record to make.
Yeah, yeah.
The exchange is you give me $10 and you get a record.
Yeah,
you don't know
what
fucking record
you're
going to get.
Yeah.
The whole thing is you trust me.
You trust me that it will be a record that I've put everything into. And yeah.
Right, and you may not even like it, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But you're basically gambling the $10 on, I want to see what Amanda Palmer's going to do.
It's a roll of the dice. I like it. Is that how you feel it is with your... A live shows now as well, because of the variation over the years, I guess.
Yeah.
Do you feel that, because again, you generally, in whatever form you present your show, I mean, I got here about, I don't know if you've even mentioned that we're backstage at the Union Chapel before your show. We should mention this. We're backstage at the Union Chapel before your show. I got here about 3:30 and doors are about 6 or 7,
doors
I think.
Doors are at 7. Doors
were at 7
hours.
And there were people outside already excited. There was a guy drawing a sloth playing a banjo on the floor in chalk. So that was
awesome.
Delightful. But again, it's that excitement and engagement from your fan base that, right, all we need to know is that Amanda's here and we can come and see her. Rather than, is it the band? Is it... And again, I think that's a thing that people can get caught up in. Is it going to be the live band? Is it going to be
they know they're going to get something interesting. And one thing that I also love about being an artist who doesn't really have hits, because I'm not a commercial artist and I've never really been a radio artist, is you have no idea what I'm going to play.
You can play what the hell you want.
Yeah, and I mean, if I have anything close to a hit, it's probably like Coin Operated Boy or. You know, and it's very likely that I'll go through a gig and never play that song. And no one will care.
Yeah.
No one will notice.
Yeah, it's great.
And I love that kind of freedom. I mean, I love that freedom in the recording studio. I love that freedom in my writing process. And I love that freedom on stage, which is you're here because you want to be together with me. You're here because we're all interested in each other. And you're here because you want to support me and you want to see what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Not because you come in with a list of fucking expectations.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're going to leave, you know, disappointed.
Yeah, completely. I completely agree with that. I discussed this a while ago when there was a lot of people unhappy about a Lauryn Hill show. And I think it was Talib Kweli did a big open letter saying, you're paying... to see what she wishes. Like, you're not paying... Because apparently she did a load of... Still played all the classics, but didn't play them in the album away. Played different versions, and people were angry at that. It's like, well, there's no contract when buying a ticket. It's not, I'm buying a ticket for a variation of these 34 songs.
I mean, they don't have to like it, but they can't demand their money back.
No, exactly. Well, I mean, I'm not going to hold you too much longer. We've got about... 15 minutes left, and you know, I wouldn't want to put extra pressure on a pregnant lady.
Aww. You know what
I mean? But I do want to discuss, since you're back in England, Glastonbury and the Daily Mail. The last time I saw you at the Roundhouse, I believe it was, you came out and performed a song on the subject, and it was a clear highlight for everyone and a great moment. So can you kind of tell that story in some way, I guess?
Sure. Yeah, I haven't actually really told that story in depth. This is a good place to do it.
Yeah, perfect.
So we started off this UK and European tour playing at Glastonbury. And part of the story that most people don't know is we showed up at Glastonbury and our gear hadn't showed up.
Oh, wow.
It was one of those shipping snafus.
Damn.
So I had...
And that's not a small show to start with either.
No,
that's
and this is a full band show with lots of theatrics. And so I sort of did what you do, which is like, it'll be fucking fine. We're rehearsed. We will just play these songs and we will wear... you know, we had no costumes.
Oh, wow.
We had no nothing. We just had like what we showed up in the plane with.
Yeah.
And we rented backline. And I was like, we are just going to rock face. And so since I didn't have my stage costume, I wore, you know, the corduroy trousers that I was traveling with and Wellington boots, which I had bought in London.
Yeah.
And I had a bra, which wasn't even like a really rugged stage bra. It was just the bra.
Just the bra you happened to be wearing.
That I happened to be wearing. And then I sort of like, I had the band paint my body a little bit. And we went out and we played a great show. It was like, and it was also one of those like, you know what, we're going for broke, so let's just like fucking like punch energy
again
into this stage.
The beauty of it, making it unique not only for the audience but for you guys as well.
Yeah,
who have done a lot of shows and will do a lot of shows, so although it's a setback that things have gone wrong,
it was kind of nice to go, let's go out and enjoy this. It was a brand new drummer, so Michael, the guy that you met, was swapped out for Thor Harris, who's amazing.
Yep,
he's also the drummer in the Swans and Shearwater, and he's just a delight. And it was one of his very first, I think possibly his first gig with us. So it was like all these X factors.
There's a lot to go
wrong. You know, and it was kind of, it was a successful show, and it was a little shaky, but it was fine. And then when I saw that our only huge review, which came out, you know, 2 days later, was in the fucking Daily Mail.
Of all people.
And it was three or four columns just talking about my outfit and the fact that, you know, when I raised my arm, my boob, like, didn't even thoroughly escape. You just got, like, that little bit of side boob, like, spilling out the bottom. With a photo of that, and like,
I love
nothing...
the terminology of it escaping, as if it was trapped and, and trying to break free.
They're always kind of trying to escape. But like nothing about the band, nothing about the songs, nothing about the album, nothing about the show, just
boob
discussion.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's just so fucking wrong. And what was so fucking wrong about it is that the whole tone in which the Daily Mail wrote it is how embarrassed Amanda Palmer must be.
I
was like, They have no idea who I am.
I'm embarrassed reading this shit.
It really was like, they either have to pretend they don't know so that for the benefit of their readership, who all want to sit there and titter, they've got this fiction going on, because it's so obvious to anyone who knows anything about me that I'm naked all over the internet.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've been naked at my own shows and in music videos and everywhere. And I was
on red
like
carpets, I'm sure, just in general. You're quite a naked person.
Like, I'm the naked chick. And I was like, this is so funny that they're trying to shame the naked chick.
Yeah.
And it was like, it was that humorous paradox where I was like, I should just write a blog explaining how hilarious this is.
Yeah.
And then I was like, but it'd actually be a better song. And so the next day we were in Manchester, I think, and I wrote the song during the day.
Wow.
On a jog. And this is also one of the things that I didn't used to be able to do because I didn't trust myself to write away from the piano.
Yeah.
And then I realized that I could.
Oh, wow.
Because all I would have to do is get a basic melody into my head, sing it into a phone, and go like, I basically know what these chords are. I'll figure them out when I sit down.
Yeah. I'll finish it later. I'll figure that.
Right. And so I wrote it on, I took like a 2-hour jog around Manchester, and I took my phone with me, and I just wrote it line by line and sang it into the phone. And then the next day we had the show in London, and I spent the day kind of like redrafting the lyrics. Also knowing that if I was going to fucking pull my kit off,
yeah,
that was going to have to be a one-time only
yeah.
delivery, because you can't ever do something like that a second time. So I was going to have to nail this song to the ground.
The shock and amazement of coming out in a gown of some sort. It was it a kimono? Yeah. And then, yeah.
And so I was really...
An intentional a wardrobe malfunction as
yeah,
such.
Very intentional. And there was actually... Getting back to what we were talking about before is perfect way to explain this, because... You know, being able to have that level of comfort with the 2,000 people at the yeah. Roundhouse, knowing that they would love and support this kind of prank. Yeah.
And that it wouldn't be a controversial... Or
no,
fit, because
that it
again,
be
they've
pure
come to an
humor.
Amanda Palmer show. It's
right.
fine.
But also that I could trust them to sort of take pleasure with me in doing something that might not work.
Yeah.
And playing a
yeah.
song that I had never tried in front of an yeah. audience, and trying to rip my kimono off with comic timing. And
at the right point whilst playing. And again, this was an unbacked a section of the show.
Solo
this was
piano.
Just, are you at the piano? So
yeah.
all the
but
drama
I was really,
is on you.
And so I didn't have time to memorize the lyrics, because this is like a 24-hour turnaround.
Yeah.
But I pasted them on the piano.
Yeah.
And I managed to pull, I made one little fuck up, but I managed to basically pull it off. And it's
quite
moments
literally.
Like those where you're like, you look back at your last 10 years of touring and all of the things you've learned
yeah.
and like this sort of like the bravery that you've sort of scraped off the floor from every stage and every gaffe and every gig.
Yeah.
And you realize that you've actually gotten good at your job, because
completely.
You can actually like, you can get an idea, write it, and execute it in 24 hours and basically get it to work, which
yeah.
isn't something I could do when I was 24.
Completely.
I was too terrified.
It's similar. Every rapper I know or hip-hop artist that has a spoken word background knows they've got that foot in, that if there's any kind of power cut or technical issues...
You're
they've
fine.
Got this. They've got this. And in many ways, you hope for it, because you know it's
yeah,
then that's
then,
what it is. Then you get
then
to see,
shine.
Look, I can deal with this. Everyone's thinking the show's going to fall apart, but no, I'm going to come down in the crowd and we're going to have...
And everyone's going to feel special.
This, and it'll feel like a huge moment.
Yeah.
Well, let's start to round things up now. Thank you very much for coming in and chatting. I want to kind of ask just what's ahead. Obviously, with the pregnancy, you and Neil, obviously, of both being... on the road a lot and away a lot. Have you got any plans? Are you winging it? Are you just seeing
how
it lands?
we're not winging the birth.
Of course. Oh, what have you got?
We have a plan.
Have you got specifics in mind?
We do. We are going to a farm.
Oh, wow.
In the south.
Yeah.
In Tennessee.
Amazing.
And we are, we're basically going to camp out there and have the baby totally natural with midwives.
Oh, wow.
And don't worry, there's a hospital down the road.
yeah.
But yeah, I really, I'm very, very into having the kid naturally and
yeah.
if possible, with no drugs and all that. So,
yeah.
And we're going to basically go there and sort of, you know, nest for
yeah.
a little while to get, because you'd never really know when the kid's going to come.
Yeah, that's perfect.
I mean,
and
then we're going to...
if you've just been on the road, it's good to then go, right, now we can
yeah,
embrace
and Neil is
solitude.
Excited, he's going to write, and he has not
awesome.
Had... he hasn't had a sort of a slowed down moment where he can get in a good writing schedule every day. So.
It's so crazy for anyone in these creative arts that are often solitary arts, that as soon as you start to... and live your dream and succeed at it,
you're screwed.
You're not allowed to do it anymore. There's so many demands.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I want to just write something else.
Yeah.
Like, no, we've got to promote this and we've got to tour this and you've got to quickly come and rejig this and so
yeah.
on and so
and
forth.
Neil
so.
Has definitely, I mean, he sets himself up for chaos
yeah.
often, but he is particularly feeling that sting because he's got his hand in so many
yeah.
millions of pies, and he's got, you know, he's always got 5 dozen friends, you know, who are high caliber, who want introductions from him. And he's always struggling to carve out his actual creative time. And I think he's using this
yeah.
baby as a fantastic excuse. It's like,
say,
fuck
sorry,
off,
guys. You
we're having
all,
a baby.
All leave me alone now.
Right.
I've got a very legitimate reason
exactly.
for you to fuck off.
And so
I
we're, and after that, we are not sure what we're going to do. I've got a friend, I mean, if you read the book, my friend Anthony, who's
yes.
battling with cancer.
Yep.
is just taking a turn for the worse, which means we're probably going to want to stay around Boston to kind of abide by him.
Of course.
And I have no plans to do anything, any kind of touring or recording, because I want to give myself absolute freedom of mind.
Yeah.
And not have the next thing planned.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling I'm going to just go be a breastfeeding, baby carrying, you know, absolutely insanely intense maternal thing, because I kind of do everything by extremes. So I figure I'll do like extreme mothering.
Yeah.
Until I decide I have to get back to work. And then what usually when that happens, when I need to get back to work, I get back to work really quickly and I build 15 new circuses and off I go and baby in tow.
Amazing. Well, I think it's perfect. Again, a beautiful mix. Not all good, but obviously sad with, you know, wanting to be around a Boston for obvious reasons, but also time to bring a new life into this world. I think it's a wonderful combination of perfect reasons for everyone in the public, on the internet, to leave you the fuck alone for a bit. I think there's a wonderful combination of reasons for them to all to just leave you alone, to go, right, it's time to...
But being me, I don't want to be left alone.
No, of course not.
I just want all the nice people to coddle and love me.
Yeah. Well, that's perfect. Well, thank you very, very much for taking the time to chat. It's been lovely to catch up. I hope the show goes amazingly tonight. I'm sure it will.
Thank you.
How many more shows you're...
This is the second of two London shows. Yep. And then I'm going to Dalkey Book Festival. Yep. I've got a couple shows in Ireland. And then I am actually coming back to London to work on a project that I have kept secret, but I'm about to announce on the internet, and I can tell you now because of the timing.
Yeah,
I'm going to be making recordings with one of my all-time favorite idols, Edward Caspel from Legendary Pink Dots.
Oh, wow.
Because he's got a home studio in London, and I've been trying to collaborate with him for like 6 or 7 years.
Oh, amazing.
And this is our window.
Again, it's that kind of, right, there's a legitimate reasons for this period to be kept clear.
Yeah.
That's amazing to get to slot that in.
So we're going to record for about 12 days. We're going to write and record everything from scratch.
Perfect. The pressure there is often so driving. Yeah.
And then I'm heading home and I'm going to take a little bit of time off at home. And then the last thing I'm going to do before I totally fall off the baby cliff.
Yeah.
Is I'm going to spend about a week making a record with my dad.
Oh, wow.
Who's this fantastic guitar player, and he has this beautiful, rich bass voice.
Amazing.
And he and I have also been talking about wanting to cut a record together for years, because he always guests at my shows, but we never really... And he sang on my first solo record. Yeah. And we're just going to enjoy each other and do a bunch of covers. We're not even going to write stuff.
It's all going to be covers. That's perfect.
We're just going to do covers of music we both love. Leonard Cohen and Richard Thompson and John Grant, who I just turned my dad onto. And we're just going to do fun time in the studio.
That's perfect. Have you got a set amount of time?
Yeah, I think we've got about 5 days in the studio, which is just enough to be enjoyable.
It's beautiful to get to, particularly just... To play some covers. It always killed me. My favourite song of all time is Johnny Hartman and John Coltrane's version of Lush Life. And it's always just felt it's so beautiful and so perfect and impassioned. And I found out years and years after falling in love with it that they had basically an extra hour spare at the studio and just quickly
just knocked it out.
And it kills me a little bit inside. It's like it's so perfect. And they've just gone... Guess we've got another hour. Let's record a couple more. But that's great to have that a similar thing of let's just have that time restriction on it and just play what makes us happy to play. And
totally.
Perfect. Well, I look forward to everything that's ahead, and I want to congratulate you along with everyone else listening for all that you have ahead, all the joys ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Scroobish Picks Discretion Pieces.
There you go. That was Amanda Palmer, and what an amazing chat. It was such a pleasure and honour. It feels like the timing was just perfect to to grab her in this moment. It feels like she's about to disappear for a while. So it was great to get to chat to her and to get to hang out and share that moment. Thank you for tuning in, guys. It means a lot. It'd also mean a lot if you could subscribe. In fact, actually, I should mention beforehand, if you enjoyed this one, there's tons that you might enjoy. If you're on that independent DIY music tip, we've had Frank Turner on. We've had Sage Francis on, who we mentioned in the podcast. We've had Billy Bragg on. If you're a fan of Amanda's a lovely husband, Neil Gaiman, who I'm going to hopefully sit down with in the next month or so, then we've had some great writers on here too. We've had Alan Moore, we've had Warren Ellis, we've had some really good people, so check them out. We've also had Josie Long and Sarah Pascoe and Gail Porter all talking, just amazingly strong women talking beautifully and articulately about their industries, about society and about everything. So check all of them out. We've got a great back catalogue. I recommend you go delve into it. I mean, we started off with Russell Brand as the first ever episode, so there's a lot in there. We've kind of been spiraling upwards since then, not spiraling downwards. That's wrong. If you could subscribe, that'd be awesome. It's the best way to support for free, because it means that we have a sudden influx of listeners, which really helps our chart position, our general download figures, which helps with the sponsorship, which helps us keep this free for you. So if you could check that out, that'd be great. Subscribe on Acast or on iTunes or anywhere that you wish, and have it set to automatic download if you can, and you will never miss an episode. The beautiful thing about the podcast is people tend to find that often the ones that are people they've never heard of are the ones they enjoy the most. So I recommend doing a bit of that, just scrolling through and finding someone you don't know and grabbing that. But until next week, and also, of course, as I mentioned earlier, we're doing a Refugee Week special on Friday. That really is important. I will be speaking to a refugee and hearing their story, which, you know, these are people whose stories aren't told. So to get to tell that to potentially 100,000 listeners is a huge deal. So hopefully you'll all tune in for that one as well as a bonus episode. So yeah, thank you for tuning in, and see you all on Friday.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.